Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. Hi, Rob Greaves here, and it's a pleasure and a delight to bring you a four-part program featuring one of our iconic singers from the 1960s and 1970s, the inimitable Ross D. Wylie. Born 21st of November 1944 in Ashgrove, Brisbane, Ross recalls his early years as best he can, but it's his contracting of polio at the age of 8.5 that brings to mind his strongest memories of his early years. Ross happily engages in an in-depth discussion on his polio experiences and the many associated issues, for, in many ways, while he made certain that it didn't stop him from following his heart and his resulting career, it did impact on those early years right through until today. In our discussion, Ross reveals how it was diagnosed, or rather, misdiagnosed, and of the treatment regime he went through, and how he has worked hard to live as normal a life as possible. He points out quite strongly that he is not a polio victim, he is a polio survivor. Now in his mid-70s, Ross points out that after many decades of learning how to use other parts of his body to compensate or even allow him to operate as normally as possible, these parts of his body are wearing and failing faster than the normal person. However, it would be a mistake to think that as Ross shares his story, his triumphs and his failings, he's looking for sympathy. Why should he? Ross has worked hard to be a household name in many families. He's led a great life, and now, in his latter years, he is quite content. Here I am, speaking with Ross. Okay, Ross, well, I'd like to make a start, if I could, please.
Okay, mate.
First of all, can I ask you, when were you born and whereabouts were you born?
1944, November 21st, at a very small little hospital in Ashgrove in Brisbane, as I say, very small little hospital. That was the era of, you know, you didn't go to be born in a massive hospital. You never had the money to do it anyway, you know. So, yeah, that was the beginning. And as we speak at this moment, I've just turned 75 and still standing.
That's good to see. Ross, what would be your earliest memories of that period?
I have some not a very good memory of the early days, except probably when I had polio at 8.5, which is 52. I remember a heck of a lot about that. That impacted me as a young boy, as it would anybody, I suppose, fairly heavily. Going back, though, before that, I can remember just being a boy. Mulberry trees, you know, silkworms, shoeboxes full of silkworms. I think, I know, later on I made my own crystal set, which is what you did back then once again. I grew up in Anogra, which is basically the entrance to the 1BOD Gaythorne, which was the army camp. So there was nothing, there was no money there. It was pretty... was pretty scratch and dent stuff, you know.
Because you're really a war baby, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So how did that impact the family life? Like, for instance, was Dad home or was he...
No. Well, the old man is a different story totally. I was in hospital off and on for a year and the bastard never came near me, you know. And he eventually took his own life, a bunch of pills and a long neck beer. He went to bed and... never woke up. I can remember as a young boy, there are obviously little things that come into your mind every now and again that he might have done, but in terms of him being in my life as my father, no, he wasn't. My granddad was on my mother's side and he was just beautiful. I could chill with him all day in the garden of roses and with cut hands and, you know, doing everything virtually by hand in the garden, you know. I remember the first Victor, a little tiny thing with a motor sitting on top with a elastic band going around and around. that was my early days.
So Mum would have been the dominant person in your life then?
Oh, absolutely.
What sort of woman was she?
She was a beauty. She had four children. I've got an older brother and one brother that's passed, my nipper, and my sister still in Brisbane. But Mum was the rock. She was unbelievable. Like when I couldn't walk, when I came home from hospital, I still couldn't walk with the paralysis, and she would cart me everywhere and look, you know, like, when I think back on it now, that probably influenced my elder brother because he had his nose out of joint. I now understand what happened to my father because I've lived it. And you can't poke the stick at anybody until you've experienced whatever their problem is, you know. It doesn't come natural to you that your father's an alcoholic and he used to bring men home from the orderly arms, the bar, the hotel. They would abuse Mum for not feeding him. Look at the state your husband's in. You know, and going back, I realise they're all drunks, they're all pisspots, etc. You know, so she put up with a heck of a lot. But she loved him to the very end. It was unbelievable, full-on love with my father. And she couldn't see the things that he was doing to her and the damage that he was sort of influencing the family with, you know.
But there was a prevailing social sort of norm in those days that unlike today, where if these things happen, women got a lot of support. She basically only had him, didn't she?
No, she didn't have anybody except a mum and a dad and my grandma and granddad. Yeah. And her brother, elder brother, who was deceased, but her younger brother, David, or the other way around, doesn't matter, he lost his life on the Sydney when she went down off WA on the HMAS Sydney. And I can't imagine the impact that would have happened on both my mother and my granddad and grandma to lose a son in those circumstances. So all of these things impact on you, I suppose.
Of course.
And as far as getting on, like with my life was a little bit skewed and screwed, and I missed nearly 2 years of schooling when I finally got to go back to a normal everyday school, which was Newmarket in Brisbane. They put me up two grades.
Wow.
So I was sitting there and the teacher's blabbing away and I've got no idea what they're talking about, you know. And that's really hard on that little person as well, because you're not achieving anything, you're not going anywhere. Yeah.
And this is Listen to Older Voices. Ageless Stories on Ageless Radio. I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with Ross DeWiley, and Ross is talking about the problems he faced as a child having come out of rehabilitation and going back into school.
Are you happy if we explore a little bit about your polio?
No.
Because doing some quick calculations, that would have been around about 1952-ish that you contracted it.
Yeah, it was May.
It was May a major 52. Disease in Australia at that stage, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, polio was an epidemic right across the world, if you like, and especially in Australia. And we didn't know how to handle it.
Mm.
Some did, some didn't. I mean, the first morning, I do recall, as I've said earlier, that I can recall everything about the polio experience because I was there. You know, I had, if you can imagine, you got school about 2 miles from you, where I used to ride my scooter to school and ride it home again. And then my grandma lived another 2 miles the other side of the school, so that made it an 8 mile trip on the scooter, if you like. You know? So I walked to school. Then I walked to Grandma's to pick up my scooter that I'd left there and rode it home. And Mum knew I was late because she'd phoned Grandma. And I had arrived at the front gate in Lloyd Street in Ogra, and I could see my mum on the little veranda, and she was looking up the street looking for me, and I was standing there. And I was exhausted. and that wasn't like me. I just didn't feel well at all. And I went inside, didn't want dinner, didn't want homework, can be forgotten for the night. And I went to bed the next morning. And in those days, we had beds that were about a good 2 foot off the ground for circulation in the heat, you know.
Of course.
They were never in the box. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I threw my body out of the bed and went to jump down. I did jump down and crumpled to the floor. And I've gone, what's going on here? You know,
like, that must have been just a bit scary as well.
It was. It was, but I was just lethargic.
Mm.
And so Mum said, no, we'll go to the hospital. Now, we don't have a car. The bloke next door, Mr. Smedley, I just remembered his name. He owned a taxi, and I think he might have driven me there the first day out of the goodness of his heart. And I got to the Royal Children's, and they're making me take a pee sample. I had, for some reason or other, there was a whole bunch of students on, so there was no adult doctor as such. So they were making me walk, stand, pee in a bottle, and I could hardly do any of that. And they said, he's got a virus of some description, Mrs. Wiley. Take him home and give him a couple of Aspro and put him to bed. Well, that was just about a death sentence, because what I was doing was dying.
Yes, yes.
So the polio had gone down the left leg and back up again and crossed my body, the germ, and it was on the way down the right leg when Mum said, no, this is not right. I think I know what you've got. She's telling me this later. And as soon as we got back to the hospital, and there was a doctor overlooking me with glasses, and he just took one look at me and mouthed the word. I couldn't hear him, but he mouthed the word polio. And Mum instantly broke down, because she knew what the hell was going on, as mothers do, you know.
Yes.
So then it was all hell broke loose. There was my first ride in an ambulance with lights and sirens, and a 1952 ambulance was like a classic, you know, it was beautiful. And they took me over to Fairfield Hospital, where they hit me with a lumbar puncture, which to this day I still say was about 3 feet long. But I've seen a lumbar puncture since, and it's just a normal needle.
Yeah, but you're a young kid.
Yeah, everything's big.
That's right. Yeah.
So they hit you with that, and that's the virus. That's the bad part on the spine, where the virus begins. And to answer a question that you might ask is, where does that virus come from? It comes from not breathing it. None of this, unfortunately I was breathing in as it was passing by. No, it's the tiniest speck of poo, if you like, under a fingernail or on your hand on
surface,
anything.
Yeah.
Yep. Right? So you touch that and it manifests into the polio, which then goes directly to your spine and then kills every nerve that it can find on the way.
It's kind of like a lottery, isn't it? It's a bit like a lottery.
There's a lot of people that had polio that have survived without any side effects at all. And there's another interesting story that I just found out recently, that we had a lady called Sister Kenny in Brisbane. And Sister Kenny, if you research her, was a young marvel for that era, in that she would put us in a big vat of boiling water, hot water, with sugar, heaps of salt in it, and massage the paralysed limbs.
Oh, okay.
Well, I took to task another fellow that claimed he'd been polio with no visible signs, and I had a little bit of a go at him, because what he was telling me was that down here in Melbourne in 52 or thereabouts, whatever, they strapped the patient to the bed with iron braces to totally immobilise you.
Yes.
Now, even today, they want you out of bed as soon as you're able to get, for them to get you out of bed and moving just a little bit, because of blood clots, because of urgency for the bed that you're taking up. So everything moves a lot quicker. Can you imagine being strapped down to a bed all day and all night and not moving? So the paralysis is just getting worse.
Yes.
It's not getting any better.
And muscle wastage. And
muscle wastage as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And not just your bodily functions, but your brain is not doing anything.
And so as silly as it sounds, in some ways you were fortunate to be in Brisbane then with a different...
Well, yes, you could say that,
given you would rather have not contracted it, but you did, but you could have been in a worse situation.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And now what happens, just to finish the polio story, is that after you're not ill and you've given some crutches, which I was in a ward full of people that were bedridden, like kids, and I used to be the only one with crutches, and I used to raid the fridge after they'd all lights out, go to bed, be good, or, you know, and get the oranges and apples and milk and anything else was in there. So they did a bit of a research on how that food was missing out of the fridge and came to my bed and said, "Ross, we're taking your crutches away." I said, and there was a, you know, why is this happening? Because we now know who the thief is. Because you're the only one that can move around this ward. I was the only one that was not bedridden.
Fair.
After but, 6 months.
It leaves me asking the question, if a young kid's that desperate for the food, why hasn't he just given it?
Well, once again, you're in a ward full of, 10, 12 kids, and this is post-war. Post-war. So Australia was still settling down, sure. And they've got this polio epidemic on their hands.
So roughly how long were you getting treatment in hospital for?
It took 2 years for me to, they stabilised an ankle so that I could at least walk unaided, which I did on television on stage.
Yes.
And nobody really knew because I didn't do two silly things like Mick Jagger, you know, Rossy Wilson or... that anybody that's on stage normally are moving around a little bit. Well, I was sort of like to stand there or sit on the stool. And a lot of people didn't know I had polio.
Yes.
And because I was playing squash as a young man, even though that was like it is, and swimming and
living as normal, a life as possible.
Absolutely. You're throwing the ball, and if you don't pick it up, then you're in trouble. If you're going to lay there, then, and kids don't do that anyway. Yeah. Kids get up and go. Once they feel good and they're not ill, then they will, it doesn't matter what they've got. And I'm not being nasty about cancer or one eye or one limb. I mean, I lived through all of that with other kids. And we weren't heroes then, and we're not heroes now. I see, you know, like when we do the Easter telethon, and they Good Friday appeal, and the press bring out the little kid in it who is, you know, this and that for the giving. That's to make you out there feel bad and lonely and forgiving, and so you'll give money. But that child is just waiting to burst out and have fun. They don't have a chip on their shoulder. They're too young to have a chip on their shoulder.
Yes. You know? The chip is worn by the older people.
Well, why me, Lord? What have I ever done? They don't think like that, because they can't. But what happens with the polio, very briefly, Rob, is that it affects the spine. And the spinal nerve ends that are close to that virus die. That's why you've got paralysis.
Sure.
You can't bring those back. Maybe in years' time they might be able to open up and put them back in, I don't know. But at the moment, no. And I wouldn't do it anyway because it's pointless. But what happens is that as the body develops, then those on the periphery of that infection on the spine, they grow back.
Oh,
not the dead ones, the ones on the edge.
On the edge.
Like a fire.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Like that wasn't totally devastated, but that over there has still got growth in it, so it'll
give it a little
regrow.
Nurturing. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And this is Listen to Older Voices, a program that presents the stories of everyday Australians through the recollection of their lives.
Now, Now, that's the upside when you're a young man, but the downside is that they are the first ones to go with degeneration, right? So the good news becomes...
The bad news. Well, it's not bad news, but it's not permanent good news.
No.
And that's what's happened to yourself.
That's what's happening now.
Yeah.
So according to... While we're called survivors, we as polio victims are not victims anymore, we're survivors. We survived that epidemic. But the problem is that, say I've just turned 75, which I have, my body is actually 80, because it's degenerating faster than yours.
Right, yes.
And then you won't be able to wear that magnificent hat you're wearing right now ever again, because your head will just be too small.
That'll be a change.
Yeah. That's the story. So then you have other impacting things like bowel, bladder, backaches. I've had three operations on one, my right leg, his knee and hip, and the left shoulder, which is all full of, it was full of arthritis, but they...
And is that related back to the poliovirus?
I don't know about the arthritis, but when you consider the amount of work that the two arms and hands have done and shoulders have done over 68 years or thereabouts.
Far more than they were.
Pull yourself up ramps, pull yourself up out of a chair, pull yourself up out of bed, you know, like you're always constantly using your upper half, you know.
And that often happens to musicians.
Absolutely.
Because of that relentless use of those same parts of the body, yes. Yeah.
Well, we said it was a three-piece band that we mentioned before. C and Mason. Now, Glenn Mason works that bass box with his... But if you look at him, he is in a natural stoop position. He's favouring one side all the time to play and to keep that box going.
Yes.
So that is not doing his back any favours at all.
No.
Muscle memory has got him doing that all the time. Yeah.
When you eventually completed your treatment and you went back to school, and as you pointed out, to your detriment, you were put up classes.
Yeah.
But how did the other kids treat you? Were they aware that you'd gone through this?
I changed schools back to my old school. I was going to Newmarket when that happened. And I think that happened to Newmarket because the bus went past our door.
Right.
So I could catch the bus in my street and it would drop me at Newmarket Primary School. But in the end, my beautiful granddad bought me a second-hand fixed-wheel bike, and I had the crutches across the bike, and the leg was sticking out in with a caliper on it up around my waist. And because it was fixed-wheel, I could pedal one leg. Except going downhill wasn't good.
Oh,
wasn't,
that would have been a bit of a...
Was good fun, but no, getting back up it, that was the hard part.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And to try and get off it and walk it with a bike. But they were little challenging things that you just take on board.
You just do it, that's right. Yeah. Did you go to secondary school?
No.
So what happened at the end of grade six?
The social services, as whatever they were in those days, they put me in a rehab facility, which I was a day patient. And there was all sorts of people in there with one legs from motorbike accidents or polio or one arms, whatever it might have been. There was a lot of injured Aussie kids in there, you know, out on at Indooroopilly it was, in Brisbane. Anyway, at this rehabilitation centre, they had me, this one arm bloke, and myself, I couldn't settle in school. I mean, I've been taken out of school and to go to another school where there is like-minded people like myself, obviously. But they didn't take into the account that the learning side of it has been left way back down there.
Yeah.
So what they were doing. So consequently, he and I used to muck up something shocking until the teacher, and only one teacher, to do the whole day or whatever, he threw us out and he said, go down. They're building an indoor swimming pool just down the back of the complex. He said, go down there and report to the foreman, see if you can help. So they threw me out of school. So I come from one school to another school, and I was rebelling with this mate of mine, one arm. So he said, go down to the site, and they're building the swimming pool. And I thought, okay, beauty. I loved it because I was pretty and I was muscly and I was young and fit,
yes,
you know, from the bottom up, from the top up, whatever. And then the bloke said, right, well, can you mix some concrete into that machine? How do we do that? You take a spade and you put it in. Right. And shoveling and having a good... Then I turned to my little mate and he's standing there. I thought, what the heck am I going to do with you? So I taught him how to find the smallest shovel with one arm tucked under here. He had this arm's gone. This one was still down to about there. Right. So I wish this was television. I could show you a bit better. But he'd tuck it under his arm, hang on to it and swing it with his body. So I had him,
wow.
I had him shoveling dirt. So that both of us were throwing it all over the joint. Some of it got in the bucket, some of it didn't.
Did, yeah.
Join Ross and I next week for part two of his program, where we learn how he came to have not just a career in music and television, but a successful career in both. That's next week, part two of the life and times of Ross D. Wiley on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.